All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Would we get our episode like cut off for doing this? It's coming, football's
coming. We'll go on getting back.
Oh, it says
like
playing music.
I don't know, you know, I think you've got to have the time limit on it. You do the first like 30, 40 seconds, I think you're sweet. But if you do that, you can't do the whole gym.
Is it?
Yeah, maybe
give it a try, yeah? See if we can sneak it in.
All right, we are good to go whenever you're ready, man.
All right, sound. All right, welcome to another episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, and we are finally on the verge of our first game of the European Championships 2020. Finally here, Jim.
I cannot wait. I don't think I'm as gassed as you and the rest of the boys, but still pretty excited.
So Turkey and Italy will get us kicked off in Rome on Friday night, and on today's episode, we will have a full preview of all the groups, who we think will finish where, and who will advance through to the knockout stages all the way to the final. We also have our say on the ongoing debacle with certain England fans deciding to boo their own players for taking the knee, and our usual combat sports roundup after the Mayweather and Logan Paul tickling contest, as Mr. Am put it last week. I'm sure you're going to give me a bit more of a lowdown on how that fight went, because I watched it and it wasn't as interesting as I thought it was going to be. But at the end of the day, I think you were a little bit surprised in how sort of Logan Paul conducted himself.
I was, yeah. It's a little bit more than a ticketing contest, but as you say, I'll give you a little bit more of a comprehensive breakdown a little bit later on.
Yeah, and just before we move into the five things you might have missed, we just wanted to give a quick shout out to all of our listeners all over the globe after we passed 500 listens this week on the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. And it's awesome to get all the support from people we know and also from those we don't, as it seems we have quite a few listens in Ohio. I don't know why. So big up to those out in the Buckeye State.
Is that what it's called? The Buckeye State?
Yeah, I looked it up. I had to look it up, to be honest. I did know that I think all their university teams are called the Ohio Buckeyes, I believe.
In the grand scheme of things, I'm sure 500 listens is not a massive amount when it comes to other people who do podcasts. But for me, that sounds like a gargantuan amount. So that's lifted my spirits, my energies just before we start this. So thank you, everyone who's been listening so far.
Yeah, it's a massive milestone. I think, as we said at the start of this podcast, we were just happy if it's just Liam Flynn. Like, if it's just Liam Flynn listening every week, we'll still be doing it. So it's nice to see that we've got other people out there giving us their support. All right, so you take us away with the five things you might have missed, because you found a really, really impressive one this week, actually.
Well, I did find it last week, but I actually forgot to include it. At least we get to cover it now. So 17-year-old Arian Knighton of Tampa, Florida, improved on Usain Bolt's under-18s 200-meter world record by 0.02 seconds. Knighton also competes in the 400 and 100-meter events. And as he matures, I'm sure he and his coaches will find his best format. The 100 meters is the ultimate glamour competition in athletics. I imagine he'll try to make his best improvements there. Or maybe he'll go full Carl Lewis and compete in every event he's eligible for. But regardless, he's showing promising signs this early on in his career.
And at 17, you know, if he's beating like the GOAT's records, it's going to be very, very exciting to see where he ends up. So I wonder if this is one of those sports where you can keep that sort of level of consistency up, even from like a young age, and sort of like, you know, span it over, say, it's going to be like a 13, 14 year career with him. I think Usain was still competing. I think he was in the 2008 Olympics when he was what, 33? Was it 33 or sort of early 30s anyway, wasn't it? And he was still winning golds.
Oh yeah, he was unusual in that he had surprising longevity for a sprinter. I mean, these people, because of the acceleration, the explosiveness that they go through, just getting off the blocks, a lot of them experience just terrible injuries throughout the career, but Usain Bolt was an anomaly in that respect. And you can only hope that after an athlete shows this much promise early on that they can stay injury free and just to get the full potential out of themselves, really.
All right, great. And number two in the world of football, Lord Nicholas Bentner retires at the age of 33. I'm sure you're devastated about this one, Jim. So one of the greatest players to ever grace the beautiful game. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, in a 15-year career, Bentner managed 113 goals in 418 appearances, turning out for Arsenal, praise be, Birmingham City, praise be, Sunderland, Juventus, Wolfsburg, Nottingham Forest, Rosenberg, and finally Copenhagen. A wide range of clubs there. His agent must have loved him. He was a proper Spice Boy, Bentner. Loved the lap dancing clubs. And I believe he still holds the record for the fastest goal ever scored by a substitute. Coming on against Spurs in 2007 and immediately putting his little blonde head on a Cesc Fabregas cross. He couldn't have picked a better game. I will say, though, his greatest goals compilation is the least inspiring highlight reel I've ever seen. He's not a patch on Dean Windass, but all the best to Nicky. He can now go on and be a full-time party boy.
And he's made a great career of it. And he's played for some really top teams. I imagine his goal highlights are just kind of like bundled in goals at the back post, because that's all I really remember him for. I'm sure he scored a really, really, really good goal for Birmingham City. I think he was on loan there, wasn't he? I don't know if he ever signed there permanently. Yeah, he was shit hot when he first came to us. I think he played for us in the Premier League for a little bit. You know, we might mock him, but I think he was a good player for Blues.
Blues did well with the Arsenal cast off. So I remember Alexander Hleb like lighting Birmingham City on fire when he first went there as well. So it was just a look of the draw, really. But in terms of it, he's not the most predatory striker you can think of. I'm not even sure he made the most of his potential, but he had a pretty long career. He's scoring 1 in 3, 1 in 4. It's not the worst record in the world, but you know, he's retired as a pretty young man, and I hope that he can go on and find something fulfilling in his post-football career.
Yeah, number three. Apparently, Steph Curry is really good at golf. So this year's Masters winner, Hideki Matsuyama, was pleasantly surprised after an impressive tee shot from Curry when partnering up with him at the Nationwide Invitational pre-memorial tournament last week. Apparently, in the past, he has carded scores of 67 and once changed his Sunday schedule during the NBA playoffs so that he could play. Could we see him on the PGA Tour once his B-ball days are over? Potentially. And sticking with golf, the Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka feud rattles on after Bryson and his team were apparently having security eject any fans that were shouting, "Let's go, Brooks A!" every time he swung. So it's just excellent shithousery, and Brooks Koepka is living rent-free in Bryson's head. So I'm sticking my neck out there and saying that this is one of the best rivalries in any sport at the moment.
Well, you know, that's a bold claim, but anything that can illuminate golf to these levels of excitement, you've got to stay tuned for. But from present-day rivalries to the distant past, today marks the anniversary of Joe Louis vs. Billy Kahn, the rematch. This was the first world heavyweight title fight ever broadcast on television and highly anticipated following their first encounter, an all-time classic in which Louis saved his title with a 13th round KO after the former light heavyweight champion Kahn had boxed circles around him the entire fight. The rematch followed 4 years of inactivity from both men due to their military service in World War II and was a dull affair compared to the first. But it signalled the passing of Joe Louis as the unstoppable force he'd grown into before the war, and the screening of title fights on TV would only increase over the following years, a shift that would alter the landscape of professional boxing forever.
So hold on a sec. Were you saying that World War II was a dull affair in comparison to World War I, or were you talking about the fights?
The fights, but I suppose World War II probably was a dull affair in comparison to
what? World War I was the Great War,
the best one. It's always a strange description that is.
The better war.
yeah, definitely. Trench warfare over the H-bomb any day of the week.
And I think a lot less horses died in World War II, so that makes me feel a bit happier as well. Number five, and I was pretty horrified with this one. West Ham United release a four club and country line of club attire, which has apparently attempted to blend the West Ham club crest with the St. George's flag to create a sickening crusade-esque badge that belongs in the Dark Ages. Not sure whether they got a bit too chuffed about Declan Rice becoming a guaranteed starter for England or whether they still believe they won the World Cup in 1966. But either way, this is not what it's about.
Europe next season for the Hammers, then on to Jerusalem. That's all I'm saying. Heads on platters. It's kind of mad that people who are, say, if you're into designing sports attire, you should have a checklist of things not to include, even if it is something as far back as the Crusades, you know what I mean? You should be sensitive to these kind of issues. It's mad how many of these gaffes slip through the net.
Yeah, I'm surprised like a supplier like Lonsdale or something hasn't jumped on this as well. The joggers look like you could pick them up pretty much anywhere. Sports Direct mainly.
I'll probably see them next time I go to revamp my wardrobe. Just the only place I shop.
I might have to go and get a pair, to be fair. That is it for the five things you might have missed. And we're going to move on to a bit of a general sports chat. We're going to talk about basically what's been in the news pretty much everywhere you look lately. And it's sort of everybody's reaction towards not just England players, but a lot of different teams and how they're going to approach the taking the knee. What can I call it? Taking the knee.
Gesture.
Yeah, taking the knee gesture ahead of the European Championships. So there's been a lot of spotlight on this over the last couple of weeks. So there was a controversial incident in England's recent friend against Romania where England fans could be heard booing the players taking a knee. And you're just going to draw our attention to an excerpt from a recent Sky Sports article, Jim.
Yeah, so the Kick It Out chief executive Tony Burnett issues a rallying call to supporters to drown out the idiots until the situation becomes a non-issue. England boss Gareth Southgate's pleas to respect the gesture were once again ignored by a small section of the crowd at the Romania game on Sunday. So just as an aside before we get into this, I find it worrying that a lot of the clips containing footage of the incident have been pulled from the internet. If this is an enduring problem with English supporters, it shouldn't be covered with hopes of it going away. The same Sky Sports article expressed concern that if England fans continue booing the knee at the Euros, it will represent the English game in a poor light internationally. And surely that's missing the point. I wonder whether the suits are more worried about the social implications of such behaviour or how it might impact them commercially. Oh, wait, I don't really worry about that. I'm pretty sure it's the latter, which leaves a bad taste in my mouth, because I believe in freedom of expression. But with that in mind, here's a difficult question that will probably get this podcast pulled. Just as the players should be allowed to demonstrate their feelings or views through the act of taking a knee, should that portion of England fans be allowed to boo the act, regardless of how appalling many people may find it?
It's easy to sort of like only stand on one side of this argument. But I listened to a caller who rang in on the leading Britain's conversation show this week to talk to James O'Brien. And he was talking about the reasons why he was booing players for taking the knee. And I mean, naturally, he was shut down as he struggled to sort of formulate his arguments against a professional debater. But I saw weight in both their arguments. I mean, the reason the caller said, who said he's been following England for years, home and away, spent upwards of £50,000 following the team. The reasons why he decides to boo the knees, because it seemed to be in alignment with the political movement. And I would be hard pressed to argue against that, because it is generally accepted that the gesture is attached to the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, we are only 3 years on from the incidents where FIFA actually had a ban on the poppy being displayed on home nation kits, a symbol which represented all those that have sacrificed their lives to fight fascism and ensure we can indulge the freedoms and even these conversations that we're having today. So I'll bring this up as relevance, as in the wake of the outcry from the British, including Prime Minister at the time, Theresa May, FIFA did a U-turn and sent out new guidance that appeared to allow symbols and slogans that could be interpreted as political, so long as they are not related to political parties or governments. So although I fully back the decision for the players to make the stand they are currently making, and I don't think there's any doubt that they are taking the need to raise awareness of racial injustice and police brutality, where does this now fall in the eyes of FIFA? And more importantly, has this gesture lost its importance and relevance, which a lot of players currently seem to believe it has?
What FIFA decides to do about this is anybody's guess. And that's another thing that bothers me, getting moral direction from a bunch of swindlers and bribe takers. Like, no doubt they'll condemn the booing minority, as is their prerogative, but they'll happily paper over any and all of the shady practices that have been endemic in their organisation for decades. Mm. Now, as for your other question, has the gesture lost its impact? We're talking about it, so I suppose not. It still riles that section of the crowd that choose to voice their disapproval. Yet, not every player of colour has adopted it as their default pre-match ritual, which speaks to the complexity of the issue. Now, overall, I'm torn. I think the fewer people walking around with hate in their hearts, the better. And there's a definite element of groupthink when it comes to crowd actions. For example, how many of those booing the knee are easily manipulated by their own particular brand of internet consumption and their peer groups, versus how many decided to boo the knee based on critical thinking? I couldn't tell you. But I also think censorship is a worrying concept, even if it makes sense at first glance. Like, just last week, a 14-year-old lad was stabbed to death by two grown men in King's Standing, who reportedly were shouting racial abuse at the kid before they attacked him. Do instances like that result solely from unchecked racial hatred? Now, there's certainly a factor, but to what extent? Again, I couldn't say. I just don't think the subtle repression of occurrences such as this, like taking down all video evidence, is a healthy move either. Now, sorry to drag that into dark waters, but sports is one of the few arenas in life where race seems to matter a lot less than in general society, at least nowadays. And booing the knee has that skinhead, right-wing feel I thought belonged in the 80s.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with everything you've just said there. I think we don't want to go back to, you know, those instances that we saw in the 80s and the 90s. We don't really want to go back to those, you know, those dark days, really. I mean, I've seen instances of people I know indicating that they would turn off the England European Championship matches if they see the players taking the knee. I mean, I struggle to accept how 5 seconds of human beings standing up for the rights of other human beings can bother other people that much, that they would want to turn off something that they've been looking forward to for like How many years? More than 2 years, because we've had to wait an extra year for this now. And it's very easy to call these people out as being racist if they disagree and boo what the players are doing. And I'm sure there is always a minority that needs to be held accountable for sort of racist rhetoric on the stands. And that is something that needs to be stamped out of every, you know, out every time with lifetime bans. I'm fully behind that. However, I'm not sure what the authority's solution is to fans booing something that could be interpreted as a political gesture, which is basically against, within FIFA's condemnation of, you know, sort of political gesture and stuff like that. So, you know, there have been multiple current players, as we've intonated to earlier, of all different races who have publicly shown their opposition to the knee gesture as they feel its effect has diminished and they would rather focus their focus and energy be spent on real change. I fully agree with the sentiment. However, the census booing from the minority definitely indicates larger issues within our society, and that's something that needs to be addressed. And really just asking people, why are you booing your own countrymen who are trying to bring home a trophy for your nation? You know, how can you call yourself supporters and fans when you're booing your own players? And that's something that brought up this a lot this week. Either way, it wouldn't make sense. Is that really going to increase the player's performance? I know that's not what we're talking about here, but surely the fan, that is the be all and end all, isn't it? It is the player's performance and success on the field. This is kind of like, to a lot of these fans, it's probably an inconvenience, isn't it, seeing the players doing this? And I'm not sure how many of them do see it that way, or whether, you know, what percentage of them are genuinely racist and they don't want to see their heroes sticking up for racial justice and stuff like that. It's hard to put a figure on it because we don't know. You'd have to extensively know each one of these fans' personalities. So, I mean, what do you think?
To speak to your point, it's definitely not going to help England perform any better. But then I think to myself, you should be allowed to express yourself. But then is the sported arena the best way to express yourself when you're trying to rally against a political movement that you potentially don't agree with? Like, you're never going to be able to articulate your argument. You're just going to go, boo. And then it just looks like what it's been condemned as, like just pure racism. So I don't think it's the best way. But the thing is, if you've had 20 cans by 12 o'clock, you're not thinking like that, are you? So it's not a logical forum to have a political discussion. And I think that's probably why they even tried to make the move of removing political gestures from being involved in football. So, yeah, I don't think we're going to reach a comprehensive conclusion here. But I just wanted to raise the point because I don't agree with just labeling people who boo something like, okay, they're this or they're that, they're racist, they're sexist, or, you know what I mean? And putting those kind of labels, as you said, it's very easy to do that, and it's very easy to reduce someone's argument based on those labels, to dismiss them based on those labels.
It goes back to that the 90-minute bigot that we spoke about. You know, I think when we had the conversation about, I think it was the cultures in football and sort of like the rivalries and things like that, and this sort of 90-minute period for a lot of sort of what we generalized as the middle-aged man goes to the football, and he uses this 90-minute period where he goes to the football, and it's kind of like that release from this sort of the monotony of everyday life. You know what I mean? It's that kind of, they can become a little bit more tribal and have that kind of like release of all that pent up angst that they've built over the sort of like the genuine work week. And I think this falls in line with that. And to some people, it might sound like we're kind of justifying the people that are booing it, but there's absolutely no proof that because somebody's booing, you don't know what their intentions are. And I think society needs to get out of this habit of presuming people's intentions based on something as sort of as trivial as booing. Like, do you know what I mean? At football, you can boo for virtue everything. I mean, look at the stuff that people come out with towards referees and players. Like, you could argue that that's a lot more sinister than just booing these players for taking the knee.
You know what it's like if you've ever been to a football game and you sit behind the goal. The amount of abuse goalies take, and then anytime the referee comes in, anytime players come near the touchline, you know that the opposing fans are just going to be giving them dogs abuse. So that's allowed within the forum of football. You're allowed to say horrendous things to pretty young men, really. They're only like aging between 18 to 30 a lot of the time. No one takes that into account, how damaging that might be. But because it's the football, and because it's not this protected thing that people jump at, like racism is, then, you know, it's just allowed. And I think there's a massive double standard there in how football fans are portrayed in the media. But I don't really have a reason as to why that is. Some things are taboo and other things aren't. And a lot of the time it's arbitrary. Now, with racism, you can see why that's a taboo. Obviously, you shouldn't dehumanize people based on how they're born, what they look like, where they're from. All that stuff's like obvious if you're like a thinking person. But there are certain forums where that kind of behavior is let loose a little bit. And I think football is one of them. But again, we could go around in circles with this all day. But yeah, I'm not happy with the way the whole conversation goes, just as you alluded to. I think it's an oversimplification. I think it's an easy get out for people who don't want to confront the sometimes difficult realities of the race discussion.
Yeah, we know how much of a complex issue it is. So we know it's not going to end there. So that will certainly rattle on throughout the European Championships and probably further. So into the general context of football. So we are going to move on to the general football footy chat, which this week is going to be all European Championships. We're going to talk about the groups. We're going to talk about the different teams within those groups and how much of a chance that they've really got. So we're actually going to do a tournament predictor as well as we're going along. So I'm hoping that I can share my screen. Right, can you see that?
Yes.
All right, Wicked. So we're going to start off in Group A, which I think is going to be a really competitive one. So, you know, if Group F is the group of death, then this has to be considered the group of relative discomfort, as Italy are front runners to top Group A after an impeccable qualification campaign, winning all 10 games, only conceding 4 goals with a goal difference of plus 33. And I don't think Italy have been very good in tournaments since maybe 2006. Did they win it in 2006?
They got to the final against Spain in one of the subsequent Euros, maybe 2012.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Bang on. 4-0.
Oh, 4-0.
Yeah. Knowledge.
Yeah, not bad. Still got it up there. Haven't killed all my brain cells yet with drink.
All right. So there you go. So they haven't been good since 2012 then. So that, I think they'll be looking to put together some good winning performances. That was in the qualifying round. So Italy had a qualifying group of Finland, Greece and Bosnia and Herzegovina. So no mugs, you would say. Wales, Switzerland, Turkey joined them to compete for the top places in the group. And I feel that this group is certainly stronger than it first appears on paper, as Turkey's qualification campaign was impressive as well, only losing 1 game out of 10 and finishing only 2 points off winners France, conceding just 3 goals. And that was including 2 games against the world champions and ties against Iceland, Albania, Andorra and Moldova. Wales came in second behind England's first opponent, Croatia, in the groups. And Switzerland pipped Denmark to top the group in a fairly weak qualification group that included Republic of Ireland, Georgia and Gibraltar. So who are we going with in this one, Jim? So I have a feeling that this group's going to be like one of the best placed thirds. And I have personally had a bet on Turkey to win this group at 11-2, which I think is huge. And I've had an outright bet on them at 66-1 to win it. So Turkey are my dark horse for the tournament.
Being a bookie is just in your blood, isn't it?
But you're going to go Italy. Yeah, I think I've got a feeling you're going to go with the Italians to win it.
It's hard to look past the Italians when it comes to tournament football. They've got the grade for it. They've got the tradition. They've got the winner's mentality, to put it simply. And I know that doesn't always work out when it comes to tournaments, but I think it's worth an awful lot, especially when it comes to getting out the group stages. So I'm going to go with Italy to top the group, and I'm going to contradict you again, and I think Wales are going to sneak in second, you know.
Oh, wow. So what about Turkey? Can they sneak through in as one of the best placed thirds then?
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think this group is absolutely set up for that because, yeah, Switzerland are just going to be the whipping boys, and there's a lot of potential there for a lot of high-scoring games and for the other teams to get their goal differences up. So, yeah, I agree with you there.
So that's going to be our first game on Friday, Italy-Turkey. So we're going to see firsthand what's going to happen. Now, if Turkey go out there and beat Italy, that's going to turn that whole group on its head.
You know, I had a ticket for that game and then the whole tournament got cancelled. Me and Joe were going to go to Rome and watch it.
Could they not like basically defer it and then give you the same tickets?
I don't think we ever chased it up. Or Joe's still got my 50 quid. I'll have to ask him.
He's probably taking his missus.
Slack.
All right, Group B. So Group B sees aforementioned teams, Denmark and Finland, who finished runners-up in their qualification groups. Take on a Belgium side who also had a perfect record through qualifying. So the last team in the group, Russia, have already played Belgium twice in qualifying leading up to the tournament, losing 3-1 and 4-1 on those occasions. So this one is pretty much a lock in first for Belgium. You'd have to agree, Jim. Who do you see sneaking through with them in second place? And can we see this group as having one of the best placed thirds?
You know, I think when the World Cup was in Russia, the Russians did really well because of, you know, just home teams tend to do well in the World Cups, and you can't look past their history with doping when it comes to that. You don't know how many roids were pumping through those veins when they were scoring goals. So I think the Danes are going to finish second. I think the Russians will finish third and Finland last.
Okay, so we're going to go to Group C and we're going to have a look at which of those four best placed thirds are going to go through into the knockout stages. So Group C, Austria, Netherlands, Ukraine and North Macedonia. Austria and North Macedonia will know all about each other after playing in the same qualifying group, with Austria getting the best of them on both occasions. Netherlands will be looking to make amends after failing to qualify for both the Euros in 2016 and the World Cup in 2018, with their last appearance in a major competition coming in 2014, which is a travesty, really, with the amount of quality they've had over the years. Ukraine had a low-key impressive qualifying campaign after topping one of the tournament favourites, Portugal, to the top of the group, winning 6 of 8 games without losing, only conceding 4 goals, so they could be a sneaky one. This could be another contender for best placed third, as there will be some pretty close matchups, I think, in here. And I think the points may be fairly spread. I can see at least 3 teams picking up winning this group. What do you reckon?
I don't think you could ignore that form for the Ukrainians, you know. I really don't think you can. And obviously, you got to acknowledge North Macedonia's shock win against the Germans. But I don't think that will translate into consistency in a tournament format. Equally, I don't think Austria really have anything to offer over a 3-game span. But I think you might be correct in that everyone might pick up a win. The Dutch, man, they have been disappointing. Not as disappointing as England have been. But, you know, you've got to look at key injuries like Donny van der Beek. He's not going to be involved in the tournament. So I think they're going to struggle, you know. I don't think it's going to be, you know, the Orange boys flooding forward and scoring goals for fun. I think the Ukrainians are going to finish top there. And I think the Netherlands are going to struggle.
Yeah, and they haven't really got the sort of striking powerhouses they had in the past, like with Robin van Persie, Klaas Jan Huntelaar. You know, they've got Memphis Depay, who... Yeah, I think he's Olympique Lyon now, I think. But, you know, he was a bit of a failure at United, wasn't he? He didn't really elevate himself to what we expected from it. So, you know, with him leading your line, you worry a little bit slightly whether they've got the quality to be able to make a good run out of it. So you're going to go Austria top?
No, Ukraine top.
You're going to go Ukraine top? Okay.
Yeah, because just for their qualifying form. And I think I'm still going to have to go with the Dutch boys second, but I think it'll be a close run thing.
Yeah, and Austria in third and finishing up with North Macedonia in bottom, yeah?
Yeah, and I want the North Macedonians to do better than I anticipate, to be honest, because I think that win over the Germans, that's just a great thing, isn't it? That's a proper David vs Goliath moment. And if they can string a few of them together, grab a win, grab a draw, maybe work their way into the knockout stages, who knows, man? That's good. That's good for the competition.
I think they got some solid players as well, playing all around Europe with a few playing in England. So, yeah, I think you never know. They might sneak a surprise. All right, so I'm going to move on to Group D, which is England's group. So it's one we've been looking forward to, Group D. And it is Croatia, Scotland and Czech Republic who will join England in a bid to qualify for the knockout stages, but hopefully not finish in first place, as this would guarantee you a matchup against one of the teams in the group of death, which will no doubt be France, Germany or Portugal. So, really, you want to do well in this group, but you don't want to win it. Croatia topped a fairly strong group as far as qualifying is concerned, with Wales, Slovakia, Hungary and Azerbaijan. Scotland, as we know, had that dramatic win in the playoffs final against Serbia, winning on penalties that booked their first place in a major competition since 1996. Czech Republic were part of England's qualifying group, a team we beat 5-0 and then I think lost 2-1. But as we all know, with far too much remembrance, England in qualifiers and England in major tournaments are a different beast. Surely you're not going to go for England top of the group. You think England can top this group?
Well, doesn't that just speak to our mentality and our punctured confidence in the England team that we're hoping not to go through top? It's a difficult thing to be objective about because we've got such a heavy history about not expecting too much, but we also hope a lot at the same time. In terms of laying this out, where are we going to go? To be fair, I think it'd be better to turn it over to you. How do you see England, realistically, bearing in mind that we've just had Trent Alexander-Arnold, he's out. We're still not sure what formation we're going to play. We're still not sure who's going to start on the day. How do you see England stacking up against these teams?
I mean, you might call me a pessimist, but I'm really worried about that first game against Croatia. I don't think that could have gone any worse for us in terms of the fixtures, because that's the toughest game. And when your toughest game is always the first one, it's really difficult to recover if you don't get a positive result in that first game. If we avoid loss in that first game, I would hinge on us finishing in second, maybe still finishing first. But if we go out there and lose, which I have just a horrible gut feeling, we might go out there and, like, you know, we'll be flat, we'll start flat and we'll lose 1-0. Croatia will either beat Scotland or Czech Republic to finish, basically finishing the group in top place. So It all hinges on that first game. I'm going to say, you know, the way it is there, I think that's how it's going to end up. Croatia, top group. England are going to go through in second. I think we'll beat Scotland. No matter what happens against Croatia, I think we will beat Scotland. And then perhaps we'll beat Czech Republic as well. But it all hinges on that first game. We'll see what happens. Because if they do go out there and lose 1-0, all that pressure is going to be on that Scotland game, man. Like we said this last week, they're going to fight for 90 plus minutes, aren't they? For every single ball. They're going to battle. They're going to battle like it's the last game of their lives, man. It's going to be so, so difficult for England. So I think we need to come out there positive against Croatia and try and get that win. But for me, it's there's no guarantee with that first game.
Yeah, because Scotland aren't there to win the tournament, are they, realistically?
They're there to beat England, aren't they?
They would love to beat England.
That is it.
So
like, honestly,
you can't underestimate that.
You know, I wonder how much they give to beat England. As soon as they drew against them, that's probably what I've been focusing on, like, you know, for the last 6 months or whatever, since they qualified in November. But that's all they've been focused on. Their minds will be set on it.
And you know what? If England come into that game thinking, oh, it's only Scotland, we're better players, they'll come unstuck. Because if you start like a flat first 5-10 minutes and those lads get stuck into you straight away, all of a sudden the crosses are coming in, the corners are coming in, they hit the post or something like that. They start putting us under real pressure. Do you think England are the type of mentally strong team to just ride that wave and finish strong?
It's hard to say. Well, definitely not when it comes to tournament football. And I don't think we've ever been a great team at breaking teams down that sit behind the ball. You know, obviously, you can't really compare it to the San Marinos of the world that you end up playing, or Moldova. You know, all these teams that like have literally no chance of competing against the players of the caliber that England have. But just teams that, you know, come here to sit behind the ball, play counter-attacking football, play smart, just really make it, you know, frustrate the England players. And these are young lads as well. So, you know, we haven't really got an experienced squad. So it worries me, man. And I know there's a lot of people that we always get this sort of like, you know, boosted sense of optimism, you know, this sort of like national pride when the big tournaments come around. And it's almost always unfounded. And the fact that we're favourites, the fact that all three games are at Wembley, I think contributes to that. But I just haven't got a great feeling. And it's just purely based on being a realist and looking at our past tournaments.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that the youth of the squad will work in England's favour, because there are some players in that team that look absolutely electric when they come along.
Fearless, yeah.
So you're kind of hoping there isn't that that emotional hangover from past tournaments like Bex and the boys used to bring into every tournament when they were going through. You know, they don't want to fall at the last yet again. But if we're sticking with that, Croatia, England, Scotland, Czech Republic, let's move on to Group E.
All right, so Group E consists of Poland, Spain, Sweden and Slovakia. Sweden and Spain both advanced through the same qualifying group, both of which played against Faroe Islands and Malta, which were essentially 3 points. Norway also qualified through their group, your boys, via the Nations League playoffs. Poland had a strong qualifying campaign, finishing 6 points ahead of Austria and winning 8 of their 10 matches. And Slovakia was another team that advanced via the qualifying playoffs, beating Northern Ireland in extra time last November. So let's go through this one. It's hard to argue against Spain finishing top of the group. What do you think?
The Poles have got Robert Lewandowski.
Lewandowski.
But you know, you can't, if you've got a top quality striker like that in a tournament, you can't overlook them. I know Spain have got the grade, former world champions, former European champions, but they're not the team that they once were. Sergio Busquets has been ruled out, I think, with COVID.
And Diego Llorente now as well. So we don't know how many more Spanish players have contracted COVID. We don't know how many it's going to affect. So how much impact are them players going to make? I'd say a huge impact, especially if you lose your captain and a player as experienced as Busquets is. I think you're probably going to go with Poland, aren't you?
I am going to go with Poland. I think you can't really overlook Spain for second either, unless the Swedes have an absolutely unbelievable group.
You never know with Sweden as well, do you? They always seem to do quite well, you know, at the big tournaments. Obviously, they got to the quarterfinals, didn't we? And we beat them in the quarterfinals 3 years ago in the World Cup after having, as we said before, one of the easiest routes to the final of any World Cup championships ever. And we still couldn't beat Croatia to get to the final. But so are you going to go to... I'm going to stop with the pessimism now. No more England pessimism. So are we going to go with Sweden in third, yeah?
Yeah, I'm happy with that. And maybe to be... Maybe to be one of those, the best third place finishers as well.
Okay, cool. So, all right, Finally, we arrive at Group F, the group of death. France, Portugal, Germany, and Hungary are all going to have it out to see who will progress through to the knockout stages. I stupidly gave Big Red 10-1 on Hungary to progress out of this group, forgetting that four best placed thirds also go through. So I'm praying that they finish bottom, or else I'm gonna have to pay them out. However, I still don't think they will have enough to avoid finishing bottom, because they'll basically have to get a win from one of those games, won't they? Unless they get three draws, which I can't see happening either. So they'll have to try and get a win from one of those big European giants. Hungary actually finished fourth or fifth in the Euro qualifying group as well, but somehow managed to sneak into playoffs. So they scored two outrageously late goals against Iceland, thinking like the 88th minute and like the 94th minute or something, to break the Icelandic hearts and all 300,000 of their population. Who are we going to go for? Who are we going to go for in this, the top of the group?
I think Portugal are going to finish top, France second, Germany third, Hungary last.
Ooh.
That's what I think.
I would probably have to disagree with you. I'd probably go France top, Germany second, Portugal third. But then you look at Portugal's squad, man.
You're the reason I think Portugal will finish top, because I think a couple of episodes ago you were outlining to me just who's in that squad. And I was thinking, you know what, man? I know Ronaldo's getting a bit older, but you got, what's his name? Felix and the boys.
Felix and the boys, Bruno Fernandes. You know, you got Cancelo, João Cancelo.
I like their chances, man. And you know what? France, I think they'll warm into the tournament a little bit more. To me, finishing second in this group is no failure at all. In fact, it might benefit them a little bit. So I can see them growing into it. I think Germany, man, they're not the Germany they have been in past tournaments. You know, look at the demolition job they put on Brazil in the World Cup. Like was it back in 2014? They're not that team anymore. So I wouldn't be surprised if second and third flip around, but I've got a funny feeling Portugal are going to top that group.
Yeah, I think you still look through Germany's squad. They've still got great players like all over the pitch. So you cannot rule them out in tournament football. So all right, we'll go on to predict the four best third place teams. So who are you going to go for? I think we've got to make Germany one. I'd be very, very surprised if they don't progress through. So we need to pick four more.
I think Sweden will get through.
Okay, Sweden. So,
and you did the other two again.
We've got to go for Turkey. We've got to put Turkey in there. My 66-1 shot. Let's hope they get through. And then one out of Russia, Austria, Scotland.
I'll leave it up to you. I've pretty much chose Sweden and Germany. So
can you see Scotland getting a win out of our group, Group D?
Yeah, I can. I can see him nicking a goal against England and closing out the show. I really can see him winning a game. I think it's just, I don't know, it's just a matter of overall quality, man. And do they have that strength and depth? Are they going to be that up for it the whole group phase?
I don't think Scotland will advance. So I think we'll probably go for Russia, because I think they were pretty good in 2018. I know they had the home advantage, but we'll go with them. So that will make our knockout stage bracket look like this. Belgium will play against Sweden. So we've got to pick one out of the two there.
You got to go with Belgium, yeah.
Have to, don't you? You'd expect them to overcome them. And then a tasty, they would play in a quarterfinal between Italy and Netherlands.
I think following on from our assessment in the group stages, I think Italy probably looking the stronger team these days.
Okay, so that was set up a tasty quarterfinal. All right, so for a place in the other quarterfinal, Portugal versus Turkey.
I've picked the last two. Go on, you go for these two.
We'll go Portugal. I think they probably would have enough to cause Turkey a problem, even though they're my dark horses to win it. But obviously, I would expect them to finish a bit higher in their group, so that would probably get them an easier draw. And this is where we go down to the permutations that I spoke about before, about England basically not being able to get out of a hard game in that round of 16. So if they finish second, if they finish top, they'll play France, Germany, or Portugal. If they finish second, they got a very good chance of playing Spain.
You don't deserve to win an international tournament without playing proper teams. They're going to have to face them sooner or later. Better now than in the semi-finals where we're kicking ourselves forever, man. And to be fair,
we say that every single tournament. We are not beating Spain in a round of 16 games. So there you go. Spain. So we are not beating Spain in a knockout phase of any.
I thought you were going to do away with the pessimism.
That's just realism. There's not pessimism. I'm just being a realist. We are not beating Spain in the knockout phase of a major European tournament. It doesn't matter what team they put out, whether they've got four, five players of COVID. They got boys they can just call up on a whim and beat our lads. I can guarantee you we are not beating Spain in a knockout phase. So let's move on. I don't want any more about that. We'll see. I'd love to be proven wrong. All right, so you do this one. Poland, Russia. Who are you picking out of that one?
Poland.
The Eastern Bloc clash. So we're going to go Poland for that one. And then Croatia, France.
You got to back the frogs there, haven't you?
Yep. And then I'll do the last one. So Ukraine, Germany.
Ooh,
yeah. That's going to be a tough one because we spoke about Ukraine having a, you know, having a pretty good side and having a good qualification campaign. But Germans, again, knockout football. They're the best at it. And then Wales, Denmark. That's kind of like an easy tie for Wales if they can sneak in there. So we'll go for Wales. That will set up a quarterfinal against the Germans. All right, so you can pick the first quarterfinal. That's a nice, easy one for you.
That's tough, man. I'm going to go with the Belgians, man. Just as the polls would depend on Lewandowski, I think with Lukaku up top for the Belgians, I think they've got every chance in the world of putting serious numbers past proper teams. You know, we've seen it before, man, when was it the Dutch played the French? Was it 2008 or something? Once teams were on fire, getting a roll, it doesn't really matter who they're against. It. Belgium, they've got top quality players in that squad. So, yeah, got to go with them.
All right, so I'll pick the mouth-watering tie between Portugal and Spain. So Portugal obviously got a good pedigree winning this in 2016. Spain also got a good pedigree after winning the World Cup in 2010, was it? And then winning the European Championships in 2012. But I'll go with Portugal just by the sheer depth they've got and the quality they've got in their squad at the minute. And I think this will be Cristiano Ronaldo's last hurrah, you know, internationally. Yeah. I don't think he'll be here he might be here in a year's time, 37 years old. He might still be here. He might still be playing when he's 40. You never know. We might see him at the next European Championships. But I feel like this is his last chance to really, really play with his Portugal side and with the quality they've got around him. So we'll put Portugal in there. To set up a semi-final between Belgium and Portugal. You go for the Poland-France game.
I feel optimistic about the Poles, but I can't look past the French there. France is going through.
Okay, France, and that will set up a tie against either Germany or Wales. So I think this is where Wales's run ends. They did get to, was it the Euros that they got to the quarterfinal? They beat Belgium, didn't they? Was it the quarterfinal?
Did they get to the semis?
Yeah, I think it might have been the semis. Yeah, it might. I think they beat Belgium to get into the semis. Was it the European Championships?
The last one,
in 2016? Yeah. So, but I don't think they'll have any such success in this one. I think Germany go through. So then you've got two absolutely huge clashes. You've got Belgium, Portugal up against France and Germany. Right, you pick the first and I'll pick the second.
I think that's another tough game to pick. As much as I favour Portugal, I really do believe in that Belgium squad. So I'm going to go for the Belgians.
I'm going to go for the Belgians. All right. And I'm going to have to go for France. I can't look past France. I said, you know, when they won the World Cup 3 years ago, I said they'll go and win the Euros just because they still had like so much talent in that group and, you know, still a lot of young players in there. So I can't look past France. Belgium-France final. Pretty cliche. I think a lot of people could predict it.
Well, I don't know, man. Like, how many people off the top of their heads, if you look through the tournament tree, you see the usual suspects. You've got France, Spain, Portugal, you know, Germany. But Belgium, France, would people pick that off the top of their heads? I'm not quite sure they would, but, you know.
Maybe not because you're leaving out Portugal, Spain, Germany.
Yeah. You're fair enough, though, with including France in there because they are still young enough. They've got Mbappe. Even Pogba plays much better for the
Kante.
Blues. Yeah, can't.
The best player on the planet at the minute.
Exactly. So this is a tough one to pick, man. For me, that's a coin toss, man, to be honest.
I'm just going to have to stick with France. I do believe they got enough to win this. It's, you know, Benzema coming back as well. That's going to add a different dimension to their game.
Giroud as well.
Woo. Giroud, what a player, man. What a player. I don't understand why people don't rate him.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue. I'll go with France.
Well, we're going to go with France. That's going to be it. Predictions are all set. We'll have to sort of keep an eye on this. Obviously, we're going to have this recorded, so we'll have to see how many we get right as the tournament progresses. All right, so that's it. That's it for the football section this week, because that was it. We didn't really want to do anything more than that. We're really focused on that because that's 2 days. We're going to be watching that first game. So we'll move on to the combat sports stuff because there was quite a few things from the weekend that you're going to give us a lowdown on, and then we've got a big UFC fight night, haven't we, coming up this weekend.
From last week's combat sports, Floyd Mayweather and Logan Paul complete the full 8 rounds of their exhibition in Miami. This was slightly more than a tickling contest, as I called it last week. I certainly saw evidence that Mayweather will encounter problems should he continue participating in events of this kind going forward. Logan Paul was massive, and he must have put the work in because even after 8 rounds, he wasn't absolutely exhausted. Now, even though he became mechanically disorganized when he exerted himself, He caught Mayweather with a few clean punches throughout. And Mayweather, for all his expertise and experience, he did struggle to get close to Logan Paul. His punches, clean and quick as they were, just bounced off the target wherever they landed. An unsatisfactory ending for all except the participants, with no points scored, no knockdowns and no knockouts. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, the fight in general, you know, wasn't hugely entertaining. It was kind of laughable at points, trying to see Mayweather get close to him. But I mean, was there an indication that Mayweather held up Logan Paul after stunning with a right hand? I can't remember which round it is, but it did really look like he was propping him up after that punch. It looked like he was on the way down, Logan Paul. You know, obviously we know that the credibility of this fight was scant at best to start with, but this would throw it into a whole new territory. I did begrudgingly watching it and was much more engaged with the Luis Arias split decision win over Jarrett Hurd. I'm hoping these type of events give more of a platform for these fighters on the undercard, as I can't say how many people would have tuned in to watch, say, Badu Jack fight a guy way out of his league, or this scrap between Hurd and Arias, which was, in my opinion, the only bit of competitive boxing I saw all night.
Yeah, that's a great win for Arias, man. I mean, Jarrett Hurd, former unified light middleweight champion. And Badu Jack was scheduled to fight Jean Pascal, the former super middleweight and light heavyweight champion from Canada. But he tested positive with about 17 bad substances in his system, so that didn't go ahead. So that's why you saw the discrepancy in quality between Badu Jack, even though those kind of things are endemic in boxing anyway. I agree with you. If there's enough money in the pot to get these quality fights on the undercard of these circus events, I'm all for it. But the fact is that there's been massive backlash against this fight. Obviously, people think it downplays the credibility of boxing when you see a retired 44-year-old former great doing mad numbers against somebody whose only other professional bout was against KSI, a fellow YouTuber, which he lost.
Yeah.
So I think people take it like quite seriously. It's not that serious. Like, you don't have to watch. You don't have to pay for it. You don't have to engage in the content that promotes it. And, you know, if you're complaining that much, just don't watch it. Like, I watched it just because we're doing this and I'm interested in it anyway, but it wasn't a serious contest. I was very impressed with Logan Paul, though. And as for the possibility of Mayweather hurting him and holding him up, I did see that clip. But to me, it just looked like it hit him as Paul was kind of falling into a clinch anyway. And the fight was filled with those kind of scrappy little engagements. I think Floyd Mayweather, and I think he mentioned this himself in the post-fight press conference, that he should just stop doing this now. He earned a cool $60 million for doing not much. But if you keep taking on these giants, these young, fit lads, he will get put on his ass, like, yeah, sooner or later.
Yeah. So, and it was more of a hugging contest than a tickling contest, then, wasn't it?
Mayweather got some good hits to the body. I think there were times in that fight where he was trying to put manners on him, but he was just too big. Logan Paul was just too big. And even when he was just holding his hands out there to just prevent Mayweather from coming in, Mayweather, so defensively minded, he wouldn't allow himself to get reckless. It's just not in his DNA. So
yeah.
It wasn't the right recipe.
He had sort of like a 10-second flurry at the end of the first round, Logan Paul, which looked hilarious just because of the size difference. And I don't think one of the punches landed. I think he must have threw about 12 punches. I don't think one of them landed cleanly, which is classic Mayweather, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, you didn't even do any of the classic Mayweather moves. You just put his hands up and moved back. You know, you saw Logan Paul's technique completely fall apart in that instance, which just shows you, like, he's not a boxer.
Yeah, it shows you the difference because it makes you wonder, like, had he had a bit more technique and he could have landed one or two of those, he might have had Mayweather in trouble. You never know.
Well, if he had any grade at all, I don't think Mayweather would be taking that fight at 44 years old against somebody who outweighs him by two and a bit stone.
Well, even if he's getting the same amount of money, how much does he care about his legacy in terms of his winning record? When you juxtapose it against the fact that he's making such like an incredible amount of money, where would he draw that line?
I think he absolutely treasures his undefeated record. I think that's why he said after the fight, I'm not going to do this anymore, because I think he kind of saw the potential for him to come unstuck sometime in the future. And I think he's better off drawing a line under it, because this isn't fighting against McGregor like Mayweather was younger. He's not even training for these fights, apparently. He's just showing up and hoping he's got enough left in the tank, which is incredible which he, if that's true. Had.
And what do you make of Jake Paul calling out on Twitter and saying that that Mayweather was now 50-1 and saying that he beat him, or 51-1?
Well, what do you make of that? It's like, it's ridiculous.
It's garbage,
like,
isn't it? Yeah, there's no way.
Jake Paul is a professional troll, and you can't disagree with his methods. Why do you and I know his name? Because he's just made a living out of just trolling people and getting people to rise to his bait in tactics. And then he went and knocked out Ben Askren, which made people think like, oh, okay, now someone's going to have to really shut him up, which made him get access to even more fights. Like he's fighting Tyron Woodley. He's like a genius.
Is that when I'm back in the UK? Because I'd love to watch that with you.
28th of August.
So yeah, so, still might be around.
They'll fight each other on the 28th of August. And as I've alluded to on previous podcasts, I think Woodley's going to smoke him.
But it's generating interest though, isn't it? That's the thing. Like, you know, you try and knock it, but like even boxing fans, like they will begrudgingly just sort of be looking out for it. You can guarantee.
Yeah, all these people who are like pouring scorn on this event, they wish their favourite boxers had half the commercial nous that the Paul brothers do. I think there's an element of jealousy there. Like, why can't my fighter make enough money, or why can't my favourite? Look, they just didn't have the game plan. They don't understand marketing, and these boys do. So fair play to them.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah, the preceding night, a proper boxing match, as you might call it, Daniel Dubois made his successful return to the ring with a second-round KO of Bogdan Dinu, claiming the underwhelming vacant WBA interim heavyweight title. I'm going to start mentioning these belts soon.
I was going to say, how many more like little like antonyms is that? What, you know, how many little add-ons has that got to it? WBA interim heavyweight title?
No. The WBA have an interim, regular and a super champion, as well as gold champions and champions in recess. It's just sanctioning fees galore for the Panamanian boys. It sounds harsh criticizing a man who's just won in two rounds, especially after a bad loss like the one he suffered to Joe Joyce. But Dubois looked awful before he landed the right hook that finished the fight. He was stiff. He was falling short with the jab. He had no head movement. In context, perhaps this isn't too concerning, though. He is still 23 years old, which is mental. And he's only had a month or so with his new trainer, Shane McGuigan. Plenty of scope for improvement there, but I do wonder about Dubois. He's got a bit of a ninja turtle look about him. I can't see him out-jabbing any of the massive heavyweights out there, and he isn't dynamic enough to duck and dive his way in without getting caught, but we'll see.
I'm going to compare him to sort of like fighters that are around his age from, you know, say different weight divisions, such as, you know, Canelo and what he was doing at 23. And obviously you got Devin Haney, who's 22, albeit in a different weight category. So can you see him really getting to the sort of heights that, you know, and how much sort of Canelo has progressed in his career? Like, is there potential there for him to do that? Obviously, you know, moving to a new training team in the last month, is he going to be able to drastically change his technique and his style enough to be able to compete with the big boys in that division?
As I said, his age is kind of an encouraging factor. Heavyweights don't really reach their prime until their late 20s, early 30s. So there is that scope for improvement. But I don't see him as being particularly fast. He has got massive knockout power. But when you get to the upper echelons of the world heavyweight division, that's not enough. You're going to have these old wily cats like just messing you about for 12 rounds and nicking decisions off you. And when it comes to the heavyweights, one shot can end the fight. I mean, you saw what Joe Joyce did to his face. Like, he just kept landing jabs on him and split his orbital bone. So it's an unforgiving division, the heavyweight division. And there isn't that potential for dynamic movement. He's not going to be light on his toes and darting in and out. He's just too big. Tyson Fury is the only heavyweight that can do that. And he's an absolute anomaly. He's a freak. So you can't count on those kind of characteristics developing in Dubois because they're just not there. I think
you're not sure if he's got the attributes to be able to be able to mess with the guys at the top end of the division.
Yeah, but the thing is as well, if he's got good matchmakers, which I'm sure he has, like they want him to work his way up the title contention and to get some kind of a trinket. So if he's matched well and gets experience, there's no reason why he can't develop into a proper fighter. But if you compare him to the crop of lads that are currently atop the heavyweight division, I don't think he's anywhere near him.
So what next for him? Dillian White. I feel like he can mess it with most people. So
that's a good fight. But yeah, it's hard to see that happening just because of the promotional situation. If Dillian White goes over to Frank Warren, then it can make that happen. But that's not going to happen as long as Dubois is with Frank Warren and Dillian White's with Eddie Hearn. It's just a no-go.
Really?
Yeah, it's a sad fact of boxing, man. So this weekend's boxing is also uninspiring stuff. Like, Lewis Ritson returns to Newcastle for a 12-rounder against the undefeated Jeremiah Ponce. Unfortunate last name there. And Shakur Stevenson takes on Jeremiah Nakathila in Las Vegas. If anything earth-shattering happens in either of those bouts, I'll be sure to let you know. But the UFC, as it often does, is providing us with the goods this week. UFC 263's main card is packed with competitive fights from bottom to top. Damian Maia, the Brazilian strangler against Bilal Muhammad, who we saw suffer a bad eye poke against Leon Edwards last time out. Leon Edwards himself takes on Nate Diaz, the aging battle-tested, and to be honest, I think battle-worn boxing black belt from Stockton, California. I think Edwards is going to do a job on Nate here, similar to what Jorge Masvidal did up the Brummies. The co-main sees Davison Figueiredo and Brandon Moreno in a rematch of their spectacular five-rounder from last December for the flyweight championship, which was ruled a majority draw. And the main event sees another rematch, this one between Israel Adesanya and Marvin Vettori for the middleweight title. These two first fought back in April 2018. Adesanya is, of course, returning to middleweight action after an unsuccessful grab at Jan Blachowicz's light heavyweight belt. Vettori has won five straight since their last meeting. And where's the confidence of that form in his interviews for the rematch? So have you watched any of the promotional stuff for this fight?
Not much, actually. Yeah, it's been tough to try and keep up with everything that's been going on in the sporting world. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see Adesanya back. Obviously, that was a great fight against Jan Blachowicz. So it'll be interesting to see. I think that was his first loss, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And to be honest, I favour him more as a middleweight because once you're that tall and that lengthy, I think you need to maintain those size advantages whenever you're in the octagon. Because especially when there's grappling situations that are potentially going to make you come a cropper if you're against someone who's just as tall as you and much bulkier than you as Blachowicz was compared to Adesanya when he moved up to light heavyweight. But I just see him just picking Vettori apart here. I'd be quite surprised if Vettori manages to take him down with the same effectiveness that Blachowicz did. But, you know, you never know, man. Like, MMA is impossible to predict and yeah. Anything can happen. It just takes one shot with those small gloves over the top, one sneaky submission, a heel hook here. I'm not saying Vittori's going to do that, but there are plenty of options. And maybe Adesanya, maybe he's overconfident. Maybe he's wrote that loss off at light heavyweight and just said, okay, now I'm back in my division. I've just got to be me and I'll win. Vettori looks like he's chomping at the bit. So complacency here, as ever, would be a massive mistake. Now, ONE Championship also have their Full Blast 2 card on the 11th, as do Bellator with their 260 event. But I'm pretty sure we're running long now, so I will leave it there for this week.
And that was a great prediction.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Well, we won 1 minute 10 in, something like 1 minute 15.
Oh, nice. See, I've got the internal clock is working now. I don't even have a stopwatch on this week.
All right, and that'll be all for this week. We can't wait for the European Championships that start on Friday, so I'm sure you'll be watching out for those. We will have a review of England's first game against Croatia next week, along with other reviews of European matches. And also, I'm sure we'll have some combat sports debrief after UFC 263. All right, so thank you very much for listening once again, and a pleasure as always, Mr. Allen.
Or no more England pessimism from you, Mr. Bissett. That's going to be the theme going from now on. But watch yourself. Realism is not the same as pessimism. Watch yourself. It's coming home, allegedly.
We will see. We will see. I personally don't think it's coming home. All right. How's that for not being pessimistic? That's it. That's all you're getting.
Oh, fair enough, man. It's been great. See you next time.